Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Rehearsal Report today. I am so excited to have Gina Femia as a guest. Gina is one of the biggest playwrights up and coming right now in the off-Broadway scene. She's been seen and developed at MCC Theater, Playwrights Horizons, The Flea, Playwright Center, among many other incredible places. Her plays include Alondra, which was on the 2019 Kilroy's list. She also has written This Happened Once at the Romance Depot off the I-87 in Westchester, which was also a Kilroy's honorable mention. We Are a Masterpiece, The Mermaid's Parade, For the Love Of, and The Violet Sisters. She's of the Parsnipships Radio Roots Writers Group, Pipeline Theaters Play Lab, The Space at Ryder Farm, and NTI at the O'Neill Center. Thank you so much for joining us today, Gina. It's so great to see you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
All right, so in true theater school fashion, we like to start off the podcast with a little icebreaker. So
nice.
First, I must ask, what is your favorite color?
Red. I love that color. I have no explanation as to why, except that it's a color that makes me happy.
I love that. What was the last thing you ate today?
I had oatmeal for breakfast. It was instant and tasted like fake apples, and I loved it.
Lovely. And finally, I'd like you to tell me a story about the closest object to you.
Okay. So I received this object from my husband, and it was it has stayed with me since he gave it to me 3 years ago somehow. And it is a glitter phone case, and it makes me happy.
I love that so much. Yes. All right, so now is the time that we are going to dive into your tragic theater backstory. So mm-hmm. So where did this journey begin for you? Were you into theater as a kid? Where did it all begin?
Yeah. So I grew up in Brooklyn in Bay Ridge. I believe my family had been there for three generations, and I'm the fourth generation Brooklynite. And my parents were like huge lovers of the theater, or what they, you know, knew as the theater, which was to say Broadway and Broadway musicals specifically. And Bay Ridge is pretty far away from the city, you know, it's about an hour out. And so like going to see theater was always an event. And so it didn't happen that often. And also Broadway is expensive, although, you know, living, we'd used like TDF tickets and had other ways to find discount tickets. But I grew up with like a love of the theater or musicals from my parents, because we even would watch, you know, old movie musicals, like, you know, the old Carousel, mm-hmm. Things like that. And they also had like records of Broadway musicals. And I'm laughing because I was like 12 and listening to and singing at the top of my lungs all the words to a chorus line. I like literally didn't know what the word tits meant. Sorry,
yes.
Great. Like, I literally didn't know what it meant, and I was like singing about it. You know what I mean? And like at the top of my, and because it was like in a musical, I guess my parents were kind of like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. So I grew up thinking that theater was great, but also that theater was musicals. And mm-hmm. I had always written, like, that was one of the things I always did. And around 16, they were this company that's now defunct called Young Playwrights Inc. was doing free workshops in libraries around Brooklyn, and my father found out and like signed me up for one, and that was like the beginning of like the journey. I was like, how can I write a play? I don't know how to write music. Truly thinking that plays were music or like musicals, and then through that program, it opened my mind to, or eyes to, other ways that theater is. And I wrote my first play at 16 with that program called Confessions of a Catholic Schoolgirl, which was so angsty and great. And then it just kind of snowballed out from there.
Yeah. So was there a moment, or was it like, it sounds like it was more of a gradual process where you decided to commit yourself to pursuing a formal education in theater?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about all this, so my parents were both very much like working class background people, and my dad wanted, both of my parents really, I have a sister, so they wanted us both to go on and receive formal education. But my dad was very, he wanted me to be able to pursue like my dream. So a more abstract thing being theater. And so he, through the support, like with him, and a more begrudging support from my mother, because she wanted me to be able to, you know, be like, I'm a teacher, or, you know, like I have like a path towards something concrete. I applied to the dramatic writing program at SUNY Purchase, and that I was accepted. And so that was like my first, that was when I was like, I'm going to do this for real, without knowing, because of that like working class, like we're still thinking that Broadway was like the only theater, really not understanding what it would entail until I was like in school.
Yeah.
And then just kind of went from there, being like, well, I'm in it now, so I guess I'll do it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel that way when they first start out, that Broadway's the end all be all.
Right. Yeah. And it's so not.
Yes, there's so much more to theater besides that.
Mm-hmm.
So what types of things were important to you when you were looking at colleges?
Well, because I was in New York, it was really important for us that I would go to a SUNY school, which is State University of New York School, or a CUNY school, which is a City University of New York school, because it would be affordable for me to be able to do that. And it's not only that, like in doing my research around these schools, SUNY schools just like had more of what I wanted to pursue, which was a broader liberal arts kind of education, versus like private school. I just felt like, well, what's the difference, you know, between like these two things? I will also say, as like a Brooklynite, with like, you know, family, my father didn't go away to school, and my mother didn't receive support to go pursue her education because of misogyny. There hadn't been, and that my parents also were married really young in their lives. Like my mom was 19. So there was never any like going forth from Brooklyn. Like it was very much like, this is where we live. And so it was important for them that I like go away to school. And so when I got into SUNY Purchase, which is in Westchester off the Metro North, I was like, I'm going upstate. I was like, it's upstate New York.
Yep.
And my whole family too, they were like, Gina's going upstate New York. And then my sister got into SUNY Geneseo 2 years later. And then, oh, this is upstate.
That's upstate New York.
Got it. But like just the act of me like leaving was really important for like everybody involved. But it felt so much further away because I had never been away. I had literally never been away from my parents until that point. Whenever we'd go on vacation, we'd always go as a family and usually like take road trips and stuff, but never had I ever like lived alone. And that was important looking. I didn't want to go to a CUNY school because I didn't want to have to live at home just so I could get the experience of being
close.
Away. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you arrive at SUNY Purchase. Is theater school, how is it different from how you imagined it? Was it what you expected it to be?
Oh my gosh. it was definitely different than I thought. The program that I was in SUNY Purchase in 2005 to 2009 is very different from the one that exists today. So I don't know. I hear that the program really has shifted and is much broader in perspectives and, you know, lots of stuff. But when I was there, they were kind of, it was a newer program. It encapsulated both playwriting and screenwriting, although it was heavier on the screenwriting in terms of the diversity of teachers that taught it, which I found even then to be a little odd, because I was like, once you learn how to position a screen, like once you learn how to format it and like what the structure is, you really don't need like four more people telling you the same thing. And with the playwriting side, it was really interesting because they really only had one teacher teaching the bulk of playwriting. And that's where you can really get into like diversity of structure, of mindset, et cetera. And so I was really surprised by how narrow I felt the bulk of it was, especially like when I began, because we were really studying what had been deemed the classics. So, you know, like Shakespeare, the Greeks, Chekhov, etc. And not really allowing for a lot of like contemporary work to filter through the cracks. So I found that interesting. And then I also was introduced to this idea of not everything is Broadway. Which was really useful because I could start to see that theater could happen anywhere you wanted to. And I was really involved in just like the like next 3 years of the 4 years I was there. I would, you know, self-produce plays in the theater. Like I would direct other people's plays, and I did one of my own too. And it just started to like open up that like no matter what, if there's like this oppressive system telling you that you can't, you can still go under it and go around it to like do whatever it is you want, because that's not actually true. So that's what I learned.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And you went to grad school too, correct?
Yeah. Right after SUNY Purchase, I went to Sarah Lawrence College, largely because when I was asking what to do after school, I was not given any concrete answers except for like, I guess go to grad school maybe, which I feel like, again, I think it's different now, but then it was really discouraging to be like, well, what do I do? Like, how do I make money? How do I make a living? And I mean, part of the thing with theater is that the answer is so often, I don't know, just like do the thing, which is so frustrating. And I don't think is the best or most helpful thing to say to people, but it did get me into grad, or it did get me like pursuing graduate school, which the Sarah Lawrence program is much more all encompassing of like all theater. So, and which is one of the reasons I really was drawn to it, because it didn't just, I had spent 4 years writing plays, and it didn't tell me not to write plays. So I still was able to write plays, but I was also able to like act and perform and direct and take design classes and do a whole array of different things.
I think that's so helpful, because we do something similar in my major, and a lot of people get very annoyed at the fact that you have to help hang lights for one semester, but it really teaches you. It teaches you a lot, and it helps you understand your collaborators, because no matter what you do, you're going to be surrounded by people who don't do what you do.
Right. Exactly. And especially if you do want to like produce your own work, it's when you do that, like you really get a whole hands on deck kind of vibe going, then, you know, it's useful to have that skill and to know that skill, or even just to be like, I support you as you do that thing that I'm too scared to get on the ladder to do, you know. It's like, it's great.
Yeah, that I refuse to get on a genie. I couldn't do it.
I respect that. I absolutely probably would never do that unless I had to like save a cat or something. Maybe I could
just like let the adrenaline handle it, but right, I'm not going up there by choice.
Yes, very much agreed.
So after you graduated, I understand you worked different jobs before you were able to quit and make a full-time living out of playwriting. So I'd like to talk a bit about that process, because I mean, I see it for sure that there's definitely a stigma around that.
Yeah, and I love talking about it. So when I graduated Sarah Lawrence, that was like me being like, so I did work throughout like both schools. I did work studies and, you know, things like that. At Sarah Lawrence, I was like people's assistants and I worked at the theater desk. And so, you know, I was just like building all the whatever I could in order to be able to like pursue some kind of careerish thing in which money would be more, what's the word? Like
Accessible.
accessible and like coming in consistently, because it was very much like, even though my parents were let me live at home with them because they were still living in Brooklyn, they have like since what I say is like fulfilled the prophecy and like have moved down to Florida to retire there. So they were like in the process of doing that, and I didn't want to live at home forever. Sorry, mom and dad. But I immediately like, you know, I got a part-time job at this group sales, doing Broadway ticketing actually, and it was like really miserable. I did this really odd real estate gig for a little bit. I didn't sell real estate, but I like basically let people into apartments and like let them look around, but I couldn't
Oh,
sell.
wow.
It was like really cool because I got to see apartments.
Yeah.
But it also didn't last very long because the company like dissolved at the last second. So that was like a bummer. And then I got a part-time job at the Apollo Theater, thanks to my friend Ariana Anderson, who I had gone to undergrad with. And that was a really great job because you're working at the Apollo Theater. It's one of the greatest places on earth. And I was basically a project assistant for the education department. So we got to do all of a variety of educational programs for like children, teens, adults, which was really cool. And then after that, I got a part-time job at a nonprofit that turned into a full-time job. And I did
Oh,
that
wow.
for 3 or 4 years, before leaving for another full-time job. And that at that point I was like, I got to not do this like full-time job stuff, because all at the same time, one of the biggest takeaways I got from undergrad and graduate education was that the people who continue, who are successful, are the people who didn't stop creating, no matter what, like whether, you know, lots of no's, lots of rejections, but they, you know, really did forge their own path. What I think was unspoken is that in a lot of those cases, they didn't have to have full-time jobs in order to support themselves. They received a lot of other, you know, familial monetary support, or, you know, had made connections in their educational settings that allowed them, that supported them in a lot of like robust ways where they didn't have to worry about like making rent and paying bills and things of that nature. That was unspoken, and that's what I put together a few years, you know, when you're working a full 40 hour a week job, but then you're also working 40 hours a week at theater and you're working 80 hours a week, and it's just it becomes unsustainable after a certain amount of time. But what I did appreciate and like from that is that it kept me connected to working class, which I feel like, and you know, just working people who aren't theater people.
Yeah,
And I
for
think
sure.
that that's so important because particularly in New York City, in New York City theater, there's a hesitation and downright like neglect of people who live in the boroughs for people who are subscribers, aka like people in Westchester that come in, or just, you know, the more affluent people and theater audiences. So theater people go see theater. But there's like not a lot of pulling in people who have the day jobs that I had, or just like who live in outer boroughs. Like there's really like these walls that I would call invisible, except I can see them so clearly, that keep people out more than allow people to come in. And so at least when I was working with people, I could see them in a way that I'm not sure I would have been able to had I just been indoctrinated into like theater as its institutional self earlier on.
Yeah. And looking for summer internships definitely will humble you, because I won't say the company's name, but I was looking at a program recently and they were like, oh, there's a $300 application fee to
That's
be part
wild.
Of this internship program. It's the whole summer. You have to find your own housing.
Oh my gosh.
We don't pay for anything. And it was like, and you wonder why people say theater is elitist.
Right. Exactly. It's that's horrifying, first of all. Like, that's really horrifying. And yeah, it just that's what I mean by like what maybe somebody else would call an invisible wall. I feel like that's pretty visible. Like $300, like that is not just to apply is really, I mean, the whole money should not be going from you to the institution. The institution should be paying you in all cases.
And they only offered college credit. There was no stipend.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they also said you had to have your own car. So it was like, who is your target audience here? Like, who do you want to recruit?
Yeah, that's definitely limits the pool in a way that's unimaginative and uninspiring and really, okay, you're going to be with very particular type of people. I don't like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now that you're a little further removed from your formal education, do you have any thoughts about what, if you had, you know, infinite money, infinite resources, what would you change about the theater education system as it stands now?
Oh my gosh, I would change so many things. And I think about this often because I am just very passionate about getting as many voices into theater as humanly possible. And, you know, I always apply it back to like what I could have learned more, right? And I feel like there was a big, I didn't, the first time I learned about Maria Irene Fornes was when Club Thumb, a theater company, a small theater company in New York, like did a commission. They do this biannual commission where they give a bunch of prompts and say like, you know, write a pitch based on this, and if you want to write a play, etc. And one of the years, I think 2017, it was Maria Irene's, they wanted to like, you know, draw on her plays for inspiration. And I was like, who is this playwright? I had no idea. I had not a clue. 10 years out of undergrad, or at least 10, whatever, but I didn't know. And I read all of her plays like immediately, not all, but I read a lot of her plays immediately. And I was like, if this could have been next to me in undergrad, it would have changed everything, because she's using form in a way that speaks to me, speaks my language. She's telling stories that I want to tell. And so that was a big moment where I was like, why didn't I learn this in undergrad? There's no reason that I shouldn't have. There's no reason I should have read as much Shakespeare as I did. I'm a very big advocate, or just not advocate, that's the wrong word, but like I very much think that we have to start removing Shakespeare from our educational system, and even in theater. Like, I just don't think that we need as many productions as we get. We don't need his stories to be taking up places where playwrights who are writing today, or even playwrights whose voices haven't been recognized or heard as much as they should have, like, could be taking up those spaces. And so I would definitely I would change the entire canon, or even do away with the word canon, right? Like, just like have as many different classes and as many different voices and present them to students as like, this is part of your history, because that was the thing too, right? Or I was like, this is part of my history and nobody told me about it. And I also wasn't given any of the resources. I didn't see it like in a play, what's it called? Like in a season, you know,
Yeah.
I didn't see it. So how can we make these things more visible that do already exist? And so I would spend a lot of time doing that. I would also spend time being like, this is like how theater works. And like, this is like how to apply to things, this creating an artistic statement, a personal statement, yeah. like practicing like a whole class on that, because we don't have, yeah. we have these requirements. Like again, graduating undergrad, I was like, oh wow, like there's all these things that I can apply to, but they're all asking me for an artistic statement. And nobody mm-hmm. in my education asked me for that. And again, I'm yeah. removed. I don't know if they're teaching that. They could be, and that's mm-hmm. fantastic. But that's something that if I was putting together a theater educational program, I would 100% have a class on that. And yeah,
because it is a business. It's a right. job.
Well, yes, exactly.
You have to know how to do the job.
Yes. And I would also talk more about that and the tension between creating art and putting art forth in to become a business, right? Because there mm-hmm. is a lot of that thinking that I didn't have in undergrad and have been doing a lot now, particularly like in the pandemic, in which I had a lot of time to reflect on what I actually wanted to do as an artist versus like the capitalist portion of art, which, you know, I am trying to figure out a way to have them coexist within mm-hmm. me and within my life in a way that feels good and great. And the last thing that I would do in an educational program is actually teach, like have classes in which people can learn skills that might be useful in the workforce, AKA like G Suite and, you know, how to do all mm-hmm. like these things on Microsoft Excel and like how to write a cover letter for jobs, which I'm like, they should do away with cover letters, but we're not there yet. Yeah. So in the meantime, like, let's learn.
That's another can of worms.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. 100%. And just like have things like, you know, if you other ways to be able to make a living while you're trying to work your way towards having your art be a sustainable like model for you. To also, you know, I would just have mm-hmm. as much information available that isn't just reading plays by people that we've like deemed important. Mm-hmm. There's some people that I didn't learn anything from reading Ibsen, and I didn't learn anything from reading Shaw. I still yeah. am like I didn't learn anything from these two. Should I have been exposed to them? There's obviously an argument to, because you never know who is going to speak to, but mm-hmm. I'm just, if there was more of a balance, I wonder if I would have learned a little bit more, or at least had yeah. a little bit more autonomy to be able to like move through school and be like, oh, I don't know. I'm like, I know who I am as a player, or I'm discovering who I am. But as it was, I actually minored in literature while I was in undergrad. And I learned more about myself and my art through the literature classes that I wound up taking. I learned mm-hmm. more about my art by reading Toni Morrison and Zora Neale Hurston and even what's his name? The guy who wrote Moby Dick. I can't. Melville.
Melville.
Yeah. Like even reading him, I don't know. I just read so much more. I was exposed to a variety of voices in the literature major than I was when I was in the undergrad, in the playwriting track. So I think that's a really interesting thing too.
Yeah. I'm a double major in communications actually. And nice. I totally feel that. I feel like I've learned so much more about who I want to be as an artist in my communications classes, because I've been able to study, like, I've taken a lot of like history of gender courses cool. and American history courses and stuff like that, and understanding how we communicate the way that we do has been so helpful to me as a dramaturg, and understanding how people communicated with each other throughout history has taught me a lot about what I want to focus on in
that's
my
really
craft
cool. that's so
yeah
cool.
and
I love that
yeah and also I think that there's, you were mentioning about like people like Shaw. For me, it's Chekhov. I can't make myself understand Chekhov. I keep trying, but I mm-hmm. think there's also something valuable in being able to say like, okay, I don't like that. Why don't
right.
I like that?
Right.
And I think sometimes our educations teach us like, these are the people that you should like love and worship and hold above everything. But I think there's definitely value in being able to say, okay, I don't vibe with this guy. Like, how come? Let's interrogate that.
Right. And I remember going to a teacher and being like, I don't understand why we are reading Shaw. Can you help me understand? And he was like, it's because he's great. What are you talking about? You know, the response was met with disbelief that I could possibly be asking the question versus an impassioned, like, let me share my excitement about this person with you. And I think, you know, I just think it's exactly what you said, right? Where it's like, why can't we have people and present them and be like, who are you going to be excited by? Like, who is going to speak to your soul? And if they don't, that's great. And let's interrogate it and like accept the answer and like move towards somebody who you are going to like be excited by. But I feel like the education in general is not presented like that, right? Where it's not like here are the options and you get to now like experience them and create your own language around them and how you interact with them and how you feel about them. For it's here are the important ones, learn from them as your people before you did. And it's like, well, that's not useful.
That's where like the whole idea of the canon just falls apart.
Yes. I despise the canon.
Pivoting a little bit. What would you say was one of the most important things that you learned in your theater education?
I think that one of the most important things was that I could do whatever I wanted. Whenever, you know, when the pandemic hit and I saw a lot of rhetoric and conversations on Twitter being like, can theater survive the pandemic? And I was like, obviously theater is going to survive the pandemic 100% because theater has survived hundreds of thousands of billions ever, you know, like it has survived. And I'm
like, the number of times theater has been literally illegal and it still survived.
Right. Exactly. And I'm also, in addition to being lucky and, you know, to work with some great institutions that I hope to continue to work with, and I do hope survive this, the pandemic. I'm also a huge indie theater person, and indie theater is short for independent theater, which is also known as off-Broadway theater. There's a lot of people who still use the term off-Broadway, but I like indie the best because it more encapsulated what it is. It means that you're producing theater, you're creating theater independently. And I'm a huge indie. I'm like looking right now at like my indie theater award, which is one of my most, like, I'm so honored that I received that award that other people might be like, well, what, why that? And it's like, because, you know, it's one that means the most to me because it tells me that theater can be performed and can be done anywhere, anytime. It doesn't rely on institutions in order to survive. Theater is going to survive because, you know, people are going to survive, like, knock on wood. but, you know, as long as humanity, as long as there are people alive, there will be theater. And I think that is something, it is a lesson I learned in undergrad, starting in undergrad when I did do my little shows or, you know, worked with people on their shows because, I didn't have support from the program itself. I would do these literally independent of the program, but you know, I was able to do them. I did them on the humanities stage, which was like the theater stage. And then I also like did them in different like corners of the campus. I produced a reading series for the seniors because the program didn't want to do that. And I, you know, did it at different places. I like proposed in a history of theater class to have like a final showing be us producing a segment or like a scene from like a historical play, you know? I was just like, we can do theater wherever and whenever, and we can step into any roles we want. And I think that's something that I continue to go back to, like as a route from my educational theater, because that's where I started. That's where I started doing it.
Yeah, I love that. And what advice would you give to anyone trying to decide what kind of theater education is right for them?
I think, follow your inner heart and inner voice telling you what it is you want to be doing and what you want to be pursuing. And don't be afraid of that shifting as you go through. So if you start and you say, like, I want to write plays and that's what I want to do, and you start to feel the pull being like, I want to also tell stories with my voice in different ways. Just don't be afraid of like the shift. I feel like that's the thing that's not really taught or talked about in anything. You know, there's one of the narratives of America is like, once you find the thing that you want to do, then you do that until you retire from it. And that's a very narrow minded way of thinking. And it's not a truthful way of thinking. And so just keep yourself as open as possible and encourage yourself to explore different things. So encourage yourself to go into a theater program that's going to allow you to not just be one thing. I think that that's like something that's super important. And of course, like if you're like shaking your head at this advice, then like listen to that and like ignore what I have to say. You know, like I'm 100% not speaking for everybody, and I think that that's a wonderful thing too, because if you know what you want to do, and you know if something's not resonating, then just trust yourself always. Don't listen to anybody if it's not aligning with your inner truth.
I love that. Thank you so much, Gina. I have one more question for you that I did not prep you for, I will say.
Great.
This is part of a larger experiment that I've been conducting. So I must ask you, Gina Femia, have you ever been associated with a like borderline traumatic production of the musical Annie?
Oh, no, I have not. We didn't do Annie in my... in my high school, we did scenes from Annie, and it was a lot of fun. And it was not borderline traumatic.
That's lovely, though. I'm glad for you. I have this theory that 90% of everyone who becomes a theater person has like had a bad experience with Annie, but I'm glad you didn't.
I fully believe that. So, you know, I 100% the only reason I feel like I haven't is because my schools didn't do a full production. So that's it.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Gina. Where can our audience find more about you and your work? Where can they get in touch?
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It was so much fun to get to connect with you and talk about all of these things. I'm very passionate about it, so I really appreciate the time. And people can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Harry the Houdini. That is the handle for both of those things. Yeah, and
she's really good at Twitter, guys.
I do. I spend too much time on it. And then also on Instagram, I have a Bookstagram. So if people like to, I'm literally just doing it because I'm doing a reading challenge this year and I wanted to like keep track of it in a fun way. But if you are into books, that is at just Geeky G Reads. That is a handle there. And then I'm on New Play Exchange, which is you can find a bunch of my plays by searching my name.
All right. Amazing. And as for us, you can always find us on Instagram. We're at The Rehearsal Report Pod. And if you want to write to us and be on the podcast, if you know someone that's making cool theater, you can email us at therehearsalreport@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening today. And please never forget, whoever you are, wherever you are, theater is not an impossible dream. You are not alone in this. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next week.